So we're in week 4 of session 5. We're working on time. So you would expect, and you would be right, that the next session, session 6, would be on knowledge. Given the way the calendar works, between sessions 5 and session 6 is when we're going to have the retreat. So for those of you who are coming to the retreat, we will be focusing on space and time. Now, what I find is that whenever I'm working with space, you know, all I can think about is space. And whenever I'm working on time, all I can think about is time and so on. So I have no idea what we'll talk about when we get to knowledge, but I'm sure it'll be very helpful and interesting. However, I have found that in working with time in this session, that I do keep thinking back to space a lot. I think I said last week that in the reading from TSK that we did for last week, Rinpoche says that, you know, in order to get going on time, you need to be you need to have connected with some new possibilities with space, and that's consistent, I suppose, with what I'm saying. But I don't necessarily want to rely on it. I just find that, you know, the whole exploration that we did with space and the field and the feel of the field, I found very helpful. And so I'm looking for ways, or I just keep naturally thinking even of ways in which we could approach time in the same way or in a parallel way. I think the focus on the story is the right way to do that. Now, Michael says here, he's trying to help me out when I say I have no idea what we're going to talk about with knowledge. And he says, I've heard that not knowing is a good way to approach knowledge as a theme. So he's right. I'm doing my pre-practice of knowledge by not knowing what we're going to investigate. And of course, that's true. In fact, let me just make that general point, because it occurs to me often. And that is that in practicing with TSK, and this is also true if you're in any other tradition, Buddhism, anything else, in my experience, one of the great enemies of insight or understanding or awareness is thinking you know where you want to go. You know, you have an experience one day, and then you say, well, that was really helpful. You know, there was a great insight connected with that. And so now I know what to do tomorrow. Well, you're already in trouble. You have to give up, I think, holding on to any particular way of knowing, any particular way of practicing. That doesn't mean you don't do the same practice, but it does mean that you don't expect the same results. You you don't expect it to unfold in the same way. There's an openness, you know, which really has to do with, if I try to tie that back into what we're saying in general now about time, to what we're exploring about time, our tendency is to turn time into a narrative with a past, a present, and a future, and with identities. And identity, of course, and we'll talk about this today, has to do with sameness. And so we're always trying to make the next moment into the same as the previous moment. You know, of course, changing what has to be changed. But we always investigate on the basis of the already known. And that won't work. And that's one of the things that TSK tells us, at least if we're interested in activating a new vision. So be open, and we'll move on. So another way of talking about this openness that maybe fits better with time is aliveness. So I've been thinking about that word, aliveness. I'm sure Rinpoche uses it, but I don't have a particular instant in time, but the dynamic of time. You know, if we say what's been lost, you know, in our ordinary understanding as compared to the vision that we're trying to activate, you can say we've lost the openness and the accommodation, the allowing that comes with space. And when it comes to time, we've lost the dynamic, or you could say the aliveness of our experience. Now, we'll talk about this a little more in a while. We do, of course, think of ourselves as being alive. And we do have a sense, you know, what it means to be alive, and it's different from being dead. But we have a particular way of understanding that aliveness, which connects it back into the self. And what we, one way of thinking about how we'd like to change that is that we would like for the whole of experience to be alive. And I think just a simple pointer to what that would mean, something that Rinpoche talks about, I think it was the beginning of the reading for last week. He says, sometimes experience is more alive, right? Sometimes experience is really alive. And in those moments, we understand more about the nature of experience, you know, just some particular, something that happens to us that brings things alive. Traveling in a foreign country for many people, deliberately putting yourself into a kind of dangerous situation, you know, as long as it's a tolerable amount of risk anyway. It's very much like, I suppose, I haven't had this experience, but I remember reading a couple of months ago about veterans of World War II still get together and meet regularly. And we say, you know, they reminisce about old times. But that's kind of a weak way of talking about it. It seems to me that people come together with friends from the past, at least partly, because there's a sense of aliveness that they experienced at a certain time in their lives. And they come together to kind of reconnect with that. So there is an aliveness, it's the dynamic of time. Another place we see it really is just with living creatures. You know, what makes living creatures interesting to us? Why are we attracted to them? Well, because they're alive. You know? That's not to say that we can't be attracted to objects that aren't alive in any ordinary sense. But it's just very natural. We find that aliveness. That's what we would like to be able to activate, and the exact way of activating that, that's something we've been exploring and I want to talk about more today as well. Now, the obstacle, you could say, to experiencing that dynamic aliveness of time is a self-centered view. And just a couple of minutes ago, I said something about the nature of that view. It organizes, it structures everything in terms of a narrative that moves from past to present to future. And actually, in that narrative, you know, the past is gone and it's dead, and the future hasn't arrived. So there's nothing alive about the future. There's only the present, and the present is this tiny little moment. Aliveness, there's really almost, you could say, there's no time to be alive because it's just that little tiny moment in the present, right? Klaus mentions a couple of other terms that you could use for this. Spontaneity, yes. Creativity, yes. Unpredictability, yes. I'm sure there are others also. I want to talk a little later about the whole aesthetic dimension as a way into that. There are many ways into it. And in fact, one of the things I think is valuable to keep in mind, and Rinpoche does talk about this, I think it's on 206. I was going to talk about it later. but let's go there now. He talks about how the places where aliveness or newness, let's just say newness because he uses that word here and we can add that to Klaus's list, shows up all the time. It's always, you know, people, there's this whole question about creativity, what's the source of creativity? And I think one of the really important points that Rinpoche makes is that our experience is inherently creative and spontaneous and alive and dynamic and new and unpredictable, but we're always shutting it down. We're always closing it down because we want to maintain this self-centered view, this founding identity. And so he gives some examples at the bottom of 206, and he gives a different set of words. The words the self has available for speaking of possibilities and alternatives, protection, security, pleasure, salvation. Now, that's a rich sense of words. I probably shouldn't even have mentioned it because it goes in, it opens up a whole lot of questions to explore, and we don't have time to explore them. But what I really was looking at was the sentence after that. He says, new thoughts are positioned among pre-existing models and structures. New ways of seeing, such as are offered by aesthetic awareness or penetrating insight, are made into experiences that the self has, rather than openings into possibilities beyond the self. That's the move that the self is always making, and that's why I was saying just a minute ago that the self is the obstacle. Or a self-centered view is the obstacle to activating the dynamic of time. So Philip says, I feel I have this aliveness experience when playing jazz and free improvisation together with other musicians and for a close audience at parties, for example, when there are no rules operating on how we will play and the reaction of the audience influences and becomes a part of the music. It's perhaps the situation when I feel most alive. Myself, so he breaks there, and then he says, myself at these times seems to extend to include musicians and audience. Yeah, it's a wonderful example. And the whole, it'd be interesting to look up the word improvise. I don't really know what the meaning of it is, if somebody wants to do that while we're going on. I mean, the etymology of it, you know, I don't know. But yes, improvisation is exactly sort of tuning in to the aliveness of the moment, isn't it? And that's a theoretical thing I've just said, but Philip goes much more to the reality of the experience. He says, yes, when I'm doing that, that's when I feel most alive. And so, yes, it's a great example. And in order to do that, you have to, in some way, let go, right? You let go of the structure that you put in place, and you let go of your commitment to keeping things the way they just were. You're always moving ahead. So that's a very good example of what we're looking for. Now, presumably, we're looking for a kind of a dynamic that maybe even goes beyond that, but I don't think we have to get picky or choosy or say, you know, this is better than that or this is deeper or richer. We just keep exploring. We just keep exploring and in the direction of aliveness. And wherever it leads us and wherever the vision suggests we could go, then we come more and more into contact with that aliveness. Michael says, improvisation improves. Yeah, that would be really good to look at. So yeah, it improves our, from a temporal point of view, you could say it improves. Now, I suppose someone could argue there are times when improvisation is a bad idea. You know, someone, take me teaching this class, for instance. I mean, I improvise to some extent. But I also come in with a pretty careful set of notes of things I want to discover. And if you just wanted to improvise, if you just said, well, we'll just play it by ear, as we say, sometimes that's inappropriate. So lots of questions there. Ken says, aliveness does not preclude stillness. Right. That's very true. And although I don't know if you'd think about this in jazz, well, I'm sure you would to a certain extent. You know, you might say that you could improvise stillness, right? And I suppose, you know, that very famous piece by John Cage, where I forget how long it runs and what it's called, but where the group, the orchestra, comes out and it just sits still for a certain number of minutes, and that's the whole piece. That's improvised stillness, right? Okay, so the self wants to structure, and that's what we're really going to explore quite a bit in the rest of our time here, and then maybe explore a little how we could do it differently. But the self wants structure. Now, I always say the self, and it's a tendency to do that, but I think it's actually good to recognize that we're not saying, oh, the self is the problem. Okay, Bruce looked up the etymology of improvised, not foreseen, not prepared, not expected. Right. So a provision is when you provide for something, right? But it's interesting that provide, now that I think about it, is like the provisions you need to stay alive. It's got the vitae, the life in there. So, okay, well, something to explore. It's not the self that's the enemy, you could say. You know, the self is just the one that's put at the center of a particular understanding of the dynamic of time. And it's this kind of frozen dynamic. But, you know, there's a vision of what time is, and that vision is that it's a story that's structured in terms of past and present and future, and that story is centered on the self. And so that whole story, that whole vision, which probably is itself an improvisation, but we just aren't willing to acknowledge that, but maybe I'm going too far. That's the problem. That's the limiting vision. So the self is like the general at the head of the army. You know, so you say, well, we've got to go after the self, but no, it's the vision. We want to have a different vision. Ken says some more about silence here. He says one could keep circling around the missing note. Yeah, that's actually kind of the John Cage point, isn't it? Missing music. Silence becomes inspiration. So maybe sometimes it leads to discomfort. You know, people have had the experience of sitting in a group and everybody falls silent. And sometimes that silence is very rich and creative, and sometimes it's felt as a lack of whatever it is you think ought to be there. So it gives you a good place to look at the difference. Michael writes, the future is given an equal voice, balancing that of the past in the dance of the present. So are you referring to improvisation there when you say that, Michael? Because improvisation, yeah, okay, good. Yeah, improvisation does have this quality actually in a way almost privileging the future. It's like, you know, it's where you're headed that matters. But of course you have to take into account the past. Okay. So we have this vision of time in which the self is the central actor. That vision, and so therefore, you know, we tend to say the self is the one that cuts off the aliveness of time. And as I said before, that's not to say that the self isn't alive. Of course, that's, you know, I'm alive. That's what we accept as fundamental, that we're alive in a particular way which closes off the greater possibilities, you could say, of aliveness. So the way that happens, and I want to go back to the first sentence of the reading for today, the way that happens is through the founding identity. We've talked about that before. We've also talked about the founding story, right? The founding identity is the enduring I. Right? So we've got a founding story, and the purpose of the story, you know, I think it's good to think for a moment about the word founding. The purpose of a founding story is to establish something, right? Like you found a state, or you make something come into being that isn't there before. And so the founding story creates this particular version of the way things are. You could say it creates a particular reality, and that wouldn't be wrong, but we are, we're looking more at the dynamic, the temporal dynamic, and the founding story founds a particular understanding of time. Ken says here, and okay, so we've got a couple of things back and forth here. Ken says, change circling to dancing. So we're still kind of in the mode of improvisation, and I'm happy to run with that. We'll improvise. The present other than the preset, I think that's the hyphen. Right. And Michael asks, Ken, does the self have to fall silent to create a missing note in the midst of a greater whole? Yeah, that's an interesting question. How do you improvise a possibility? Does that mean you have to let go of what's already there? One way of doing that would be for the self to fall silent. Okay. So I want to move away from that a little and follow the thread of the text where we're looking at this founding identity. And remember, we've talked about this from time to time, the word identity means sameness, like identical. So when you have an identity, it means that you're insisting that you are the same. And of course, you assign identities to other things, or you recognize identities in other things. So there's this fundamental quality of sameness. And in terms of the dynamic of time, what that means is that you end up freezing the aliveness of time. Because you're committed to sameness. So the self, the relationship of the self to everything that shows up in time, it's a big issue, and Rinpoche explores it really extensively in the various TSK books, and probably the most here in Love of Knowledge, but certainly also in Dynamics and elsewhere. The self, in effect, the founding story is that the self is frozen. It experiences time, or it engages time, but there's this core identity which doesn't change. That's what it means to be a self. And in effect, what that means is that the self steps outside of time. It takes this privileged position, and that's, you know, also the position of the witness. So the self understands the witness as itself, or the witness. Say it the other way around, the witness presents the self as the witness. That's part of what the story the witness tells, you could say. So the self is very involved in the world where everything is constantly changing, you know, a world that unfolds from past to present to future. But the whole idea of a self is that whatever is going on, I stay myself. There's some this core identity, and that is outside of time. And so in this chapter, in the first part of the chapter, one of the things that Rinpoche does is point out how unworkable it is to hold that view. And he does that often in the TSK books. You know, he will really kind of explore the logic of taking a particular position. And it's always an interesting question whether, you know, is that convincing to people? In other words, if you show that there's a logical problem with the position that you're holding, it doesn't necessarily mean that you then drop the position. You know, people tend to hold on to their positions even if they can't support them logically. You might say, well, why does Rinpoche spend, you know, time to do that? Why does he make that a focus of the presentation? And I think the answer to that is maybe twofold. One is, if somebody makes a logical argument that shows that the position you just automatically accept, not that you've worked it out, but you're willing to agree that that's the way you think about things. Like, yes, there's a self and it exists outside of time. If somebody shows you that that's not logical, you should be willing, you should be ready to question it. You should say, well, there's something wrong here. And maybe it's partly because Rinpoche comes out of a tradition of Buddhist philosophy where people argued, you know, about the logic of these things, that he's drawn to present things in that way. But for us, you know, either the logical problem should wake us up to something problematic, or the fact that we reject the logic and say, I don't care what the logic is, this is how I feel about it, that should wake us up. Why in the world do we take that position? So one way or another, the possibility is there of waking us up. And so that's what Rinpoche does. I just want to give you part of the argument here on 202. And he's talked about the self that's objective or historically conditioned. And he says that doesn't really account for this sense of the self as being unchanged. You know, that there's this self who stands in the middle of experience and is unchanged in the middle of experience. And so if you leave that out, it's like you may get back to logical consistency, but you've lost your own experience. So let's look at then the first paragraph on 202. He says the alternative view maintains the independence of the self from history. So that's what I've been saying, that there's that we think no matter what happens, I'm me. Right? Holding that the founding entity is unaffected by change. But this view encounters other difficulties. If the owner is separate from the objective self, that was in the previous paragraph, but, you know, that's the one that has two arms and you know, white hair and grew up in California, you know, the kind of historical self. So he says, this view encounters other difficulties. If the owner is separate from the objective self, in what sense are the two selves nonetheless one and the same? So this is a question, you know, and it's well worth thinking about, well worth exploring. We understand the witness is telling us that I, so this unchanging I, am also the objective self, this specific individual self, is the meaning giver and memory holder. But the owner makes the objective self into a possession rather than an actor, assigning itself the title of knower and meaning giver. Just who knows whom, and who in turn knows the knower? If the objective self is only our possession, what accounts for our sense, verified by the witness, that we are it? If we are not it, who are we? We're not going to go into those questions, but they're all important questions to reflect on. So Ken says, Zeno's paradox does not keep us from thinking that we go places. So you probably are familiar with Zeno's paradox, but maybe not. It basically says, if you want to go from point A to point B, first you go halfway there, and then you go half the remaining distance, and then you go half the remaining distance. And so the reality is that you can never get to point B because there's always another half that you haven't traversed. And he says, yeah, so the logic keeps us, the logic points to the fact that we can never actually go somewhere, but in fact we go somewhere all the time and we don't care about that logic. So, that might be a response to saying, well, if your logic leads you to a certain conclusion, but you reject that conclusion, you should be asking what's going on. And I think that's true for Zeno, too. You should be asking what's going on. That particular example, I was going to say it's not so practical, but you could say it is. We do, after all, we go places all the time. So you need to think, what's going on? If there's a logical problem, if there's a paradox, then there's something wrong with the way we understand the situation. There's something wrong with our fundamental premises. And if we could get to the bottom of that, that might be really important. And so, for example, and I'm not proposing this as a solution to Zeno's paradox, but you might say the situation is problematic because we assume it's always the same person who's going from point A to point B. If it's a different person, or at least if our sense of identity doesn't take form the way we think, then maybe the paradox looks very different. Okay, let me go and see. There's a couple of comments. A couple of comments that have scrolled off my chat window, so I'm going to look at it here. Okay, Michael says, I find that I can't believe that I have a problem until I see the possibility of a solution. Yeah, psychologically, that makes good sense, doesn't it? But you might ask, well, how do you even identify something as a possible solution until you realize you have a problem? Well, maybe there's a way. Being told that I'm operating in a flawed way only sinks in once I can see a way out of that fallacy. Rinpoche always follows his painful exposés of the nonsensical view of time with a new path into a richer kind of time. Then I can begin paying more attention to the new possibility. Yeah, I think that's well put, Michael, and it's true. People sometimes get impatient with parts of the presentation in TSK, and I think that impatience, where Rinpoche is doing a kind of pointing out the logical problems, in this case, the logical problem of having a self that's outside of time and yet somehow it's the same as the historical self or the objective self, and how can those two possibly be linked? And well, maybe there's two times, he considers that, maybe they're parallel, and he raises all these issues, and sometimes people get impatient. That impatience might be the same impatience that you feel in the face of Zeno and his paradox, or it might be an impatience that's more related to what you're saying, and maybe those two are the same, Michael, to what you're saying, that I accept that there's a kind of a logical problem, but I don't see any way out of it. So it's not just that I'm not interested in hearing it, but I'm radically opposed to really recognizing that there's a problem, because I'll just be left feeling helpless, hopeless. So, maybe you hold those possibilities in mind, and then when Rinpoche does suggest another possibility, now you say, okay, now I'm willing to consider it. And in part, that's what we try to do here. But in part, it also has to operate the other way. It's like if you don't recognize that there's a potential problem, you're never going to be open to hearing about a solution. So, okay, these are all valuable questions. Because they show us something, or they suggest, how do you go about exploring the TSK vision, or even more fundamentally, because it's not that the point is to be loyal to the TSK vision. The point is to activate a new vision, a new way of being. how do you do that? And so there are these different moves that get made. How do they fit together? Those are good questions to ask. So Ken says, that's cool. I'm not quite sure what's cool yet. what's going on? One great question. Okay, well, I that's a good question, a wonderful question. I don't exactly relate it back to what Michael was saying, but if you want to say more, Ken, that's fine. Karen says, perhaps we cannot follow the logic that the self is only a story because we cannot imagine another possibility. We cannot live with no answers. And Klaus responds, the alternative is choosing the unknown. Now, I hesitate because, you know, these are important big issues. It's true. You know, we don't have a good way to imagine a world without a self. And I think it's important to acknowledge that that's not what TSK asked us to do. It does ask us to be willing to let go of the commitment, the kind of existential commitment to the self and its world and its narrative and the founding story and all of that. All that can be in operation without it limiting the possibility of, let's say now, improvisation or aliveness or creativity. We have learned to see it as a limitation on aliveness. And Klaus says, I think answering or commenting on Karen, Karen said, we can't imagine another possibility and we can't live with no answers. And Klaus says, well, the alternative is choosing the unknown. That's a tension. I'm not going to try to resolve that. I think it's a great tension. You know, on the one hand, we say we're not willing to live with no answers, and that's something, let's talk about that in a moment. And the alternative, which Rinpoche mentions, and as Michael said at the beginning of the class, we will explore that more when we deal with the knowledge section of TSK. The alternative is no, to be willing to choose the unknown. Right? So in this chapter, Rinpoche says very, very specifically that we do choose to adopt a view of the self as outside of time because it gives us security. So on 204, where he's talking about that, he says, when the self accepts, at the beginning of that section, when the self accepts the founding story and its own objective being as real, it subjects itself to history. So that's a certain bargain that the self makes. It says, okay, I'll go along with history because at least that way, I don't have to live in this anxious situation of having no answer, as Karen said. You know, I don't have to live with this kind of completely open set of possibilities. At least I know the self is there. It kind of goes back to the Cartesian move, right? And Philip reminds us, he says, when I'm playing improvised music, no one's choosing the known and no one's choosing the unknown. There's no need to choose. Yeah, so choosing the unknown, that's a nice corrective because it's not as though the self says, oh, I'll choose to the unknown. You know, that would already be a little bit of a problem. But the self does choose to subject itself to history. It chooses, you could say, not to improvise, you know. There's a story that I'm not going to tell because we don't have enough time. So this is what's discussed on pages 204 and 5. The self makes a commitment to its own identity, its own sameness. And It does that. It makes that commitment because that way it, at least it can, it, there's something solid, right? There's that, so there's that italic line toward the bottom of the page for a being that occupies the seeming twilight zone of a momentary, constantly shifting present. So this, of course, goes back, to things we've talked about in the past, that it seems like our sense of the present is very inadequate. But again, you could say it's kind of a logical inadequacy. But still, he says, if the self is committed to that view that the present is just this fleeting moment, then we need a guarantee. We need something that will stabilize us, that will bring us back. So that guarantee, he says, has great significance, right? And the result of that, I'm going to go ahead and follow that thought out for a moment and then go to several comments that people have made, which are great. So he follows that out on 205. He says, when the self makes that commitment, when it chooses its own identity, right? When it chooses not to be creative, when it chooses not to improvise, when it chooses not to go with the dynamic, as under such circumstances, time is no longer alive with the vitality of the present. Instead, it once more becomes a lifeless measuring stick for distance and decay. So this is the starting idea of time where we say, well, it's just, you know, what, tick, 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 tick. It's just the clock, you know. And we lose the aliveness of it. And the aliveness becomes very mysterious for us. But we don't, in any event, have access to it. Okay, I'm just not going to go farther with that because there's a lot going on. I mean, I want to go back and look at what people have been saying. And then we'll end. So I'm actually going to start in the middle of these comments because Klaus was responding to something Philip said. Philip said, when I'm improvising, there's no one choosing, right? And Klaus says, the self cannot choose. Well, actually, I commented and said, right, there's a problem if the self has to be the one who chooses. Klaus says, the self cannot choose, but a wider knowing can. Right. You know, you might want to say that differently and say, that's exactly what it means to say there doesn't have to be a choice or there isn't a choice at all, because in this wider knowing, there's just the spontaneous responsiveness, something like that. But those are the areas that we're exploring, and if we could activate the dynamic of time more fully, well, yes. So let's go back and look at some of these other comments, because I think it's great that people are engaging this. Michael says, I bet everyone in this class has made the leap into the unknown at some personal juncture. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here listening to Jack on a Sunday morning. Yeah, that's true. Who knows what that crazy guy Jack is going to say? So that's unknown. But yeah, there's a yes. That seems right to me. And John says, responding to Philip and what he was saying about improvisation, focused physical doing bypasses the thinking of the self and enters into a more profound flow. I experience this in climbing and tracking. So yeah, physical doing is a wonderful example. Of course, dance is a great example. It's one that Rinpoche likes to use. Climbing and tracking. It'd be very interesting to hear more about tracking, John, which I know you do. But climbing we can kind of get a sense of. It's interesting because it seems like there's three possibilities, right? One is you do something in kind of a mechanical way. I'm thinking now about physical things. So when you're learning, let's say you're learning to ride a bicycle, so you're just aware and sensitive to everything, right? And then there's you bypass the thinking and you enter into a more profound flow. So you finally get how to ride a bicycle or whatever else it is. And that has this quality of spontaneous aliveness. But then, of course, the very next thing that happens is it becomes habit, right? I shouldn't say the very next thing, but the risk at that point is that it turns into habit, which means, you know, you're not thinking about it, but you're also not engaging the flow. So those are three alternatives, and how they fit together is very interesting question. So Philip agrees with John. So improvisation and climbing and physical activity in general. Now, do we have to be engaged in physical activity or in creating something through improvisation and music or dance or whatever it is? No. But we would want to bring that same quality into every moment of experience. And we actually do. You know, it's amazing how we tend not to be aware of how much we're always creating the next moment. And that's because we're always holding on to an identity and a sense of the past. So an example that I like to use, some of you have probably heard me say this, I like to use it because it always comes up whenever I'm teaching something like this, is that the very saying of what I'm saying is an improvisation. You know, I do not know what I'm going to be saying until I've said it. And we tend to miss that. We tend to think, oh, you know what you're going to say. And sometimes you plan it out in advance, but usually you don't. Usually you're responding to the situation. And that's so obvious in a sense that we miss it. We don't see it. It's sort of mistaking the habit for or turning the flow into a habit, missing the aliveness. There's many, many ways in which we miss this aliveness. It's actually available to us. Okay. So John says, or asks, so the question is, how do we access this more profound flow in every activity internally in our experience of thinking and and storytelling, going deeper. How do we do that? Yes, that is the question. It's exactly what we're looking at. And then Hayward asks, does the self choose to know, or is self a consequence of a way of knowing? Right. I'm not sure those are the only alternatives, but we've already talked about how maybe if the self chooses to know, it can make that choice, but it, as a result, there's a lot that stays unknown. Is the self a consequence of a way of knowing? Yeah, I'm just hesitating a little over that exact formulation, but this notion that the founding identity, the founding story, that is a choice to know reality or to know experience in a certain way, and so then the self comes to the fore. The image that comes to mind is imagine you had imagine you had a robot that was delivered to you in a package, and you open the package and you turn on the switch and the robot says, hi, I'm R2-D2. It pops into being kind of, and it gets out of the box and it starts doing whatever it's doing. Well, that's kind of the self. You know, the self is the consequence of a particular way of knowing, a choice that we make. Ron says there's a Zen saying, I don't know if I think of it as a Zen saying, but yeah, beyond picking and choosing, right? The self is not choosing, I would say that. The Zen valuing of spontaneous knowing or acting. That's right. But I think it's good to keep in mind the question that John raises. Is that spontaneous knowing or acting? Do we have to look for special moments to be spontaneous? Or is that spontaneity, that aliveness, available in every moment? And clearly there's no contradiction there, but it's really good to keep in mind. We don't have to be, there are all these stories of Zen masters doing spontaneous things. And those are very demonstrative. They help show a possibility. But, couldn't that also be available in every action that we take? Okay. He quotes, Ken writes here and quotes a fellow named Tom Gunn, open interest bypasses the self like love. Yeah, open interest, caring, engaging, in TSK, especially in this book, Love of Knowledge, we talk about free and open inquiry. And yeah, I think the possibility is there of bypassing the self. That's great. And love. But we'll leave that undiscussed for now. Philip says, I often think we should cultivate simultaneous talking in work meetings, as in music improvisation, forcing everyone to be spontaneous without falling into habits. Well, that would be interesting to try. It sounds like it would be very noisy. But I guess it would fall into place is the idea, something like that. Results can be very interesting, as I've found in some simple experiments. Okay, well, sometime we'll figure out a way to engage in such experiments. And Ron says, ordinary mind is the way, and I'm going to take that. I think it's the last comment. Yes, it is. I'm going to take that as the final comment for us, too. So I was going to do a practice here, but I'll include it in the orientation. And it's not, the practices that I've been working with, the walkabouts especially, are, you know, they grow out of things that are in the text and things we've been discussing. So I think that'll be clear. Okay, so next week we're going to continue to explore the self, but we're going to move on to knowledge of time and space. So we saw a little bit about how the self gets explored in sacred dimensions. We didn't talk about that today. So now we're going to go on and look at it in terms of knowledge of time and space. So I think it's great to be able to come at it from all these different perspectives. So, see you next week.